Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Extra, hear all about it, exclusive to the Savage Nation. We're the first in the nation. We won't be the last. We have finally gotten something. We have investigated Madoff's judge. People are asking, why is Bernie Madoff living in a $9 million condominium or co-op instead of spending his time in jail? And no one can answer the question. There are cries from New York to New Delhi demanding that Bernie Madoff be remanded to jail until he is brought to trial. Now, people have asked why this is going on. How come he's being given special treatment? How come even after it was found, he mailed $1 million worth of jewelry to relatives, and that there were several $100 million worth of checks on his counter, on his desk, about to be mailed out to friends and family? $173 million was about to be mailed out to friends and family, prosecutors contend. That came out today. And yet, the judge has not jailed him. A ruling from Judge Ellis on the bond revocation is expected by Monday. They keep delaying it. So I asked myself, who is Judge Ellis? Well, today, without accusing Judge Ellis of any wrongdoing, we have many questions to ask. And tell me if I'm being unreasonable when I expose to you the fact that Magistrate Judge Ronald L. Ellis joined the staff of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund in 1976. In 1984, Judge Ellis worked for the NAACP in the National Fair Employment Program, specializing in class actions. From 1990 until his appointment as a magistrate judge, Judge Ellis was the director of the NAACP Fund's Poverty and Justice Program. Judge Ellis has served as an adjunct professor of law at NYU School of Law and at New York Law School. He is a member of the American Bar Association, the Metropolitan Black Bar Association, and the Federal Bar Council. Here are some of the questions. Is it not likely that at least one of the charities Madoff enriched and then robbed, allegedly, no doubt contributed to the NAACP at some time? And if one of the charities, remember, they're all liberal charities, many of the Jewish people who were allegedly scammed by Bernie Madoff gave a lot of money to Jewish charities. A lot of the Jewish charities had their money managed by Madoff, and they were robbed. Isn't it likely that a lot of this money or some of the money went to the NAACP at some time? If so, would this not present a clear conflict of interest for Judge Ellis? And must Judge Ellis now recuse himself or face an investigation himself? The question is, did Madoff indirectly ever contribute dollars to any of these charities? Meaning himself. Did he send money to any of these charities? Did Madoff or anyone in the Madoff family ever send money to the NYU Law School? Did Madoff or any of Madoff's family members ever send money to the NAACP Poverty and Justice Program? There are enough questions that lead me to say to you, the American people, you must demand that Judge Ellis recuse himself from the Madoff case immediately. Do you agree with me or disagree with me? I know many of you can't comment because you haven't heard this anywhere else. You haven't heard it on Fox News. You haven't heard it on CNN. You haven't heard it on any other show. But we did the research. It was very hard to find, and we finally found it. Now, some of the stories on MichaelSavage.com that you probably can comment upon include the following. My number two headline is Morons Read Yahoo News. What's shocking to me is that Yahoo searches for missing toddler Kaylee Anthony and her jailed mother Casey were the second most sought after terms on the search engine called Yahoo in 2008. Do you realize how many idiots get all of their news from Yahoo News? Are you aware of the fact that millions of dumb housewives have nothing to do but stay at home and surf the internet? and receive almost all of their news from search engines such as Google or Yahoo News. And this is all they're concerned about is Kaylee Anthony. Doesn't this explain an awful lot to you right now? Now, if you want to read about the story I'm talking about, which is Madoff's judge, please go to michaelsavage.com. Again, without accusing Judge Ellis of any wrongdoing, I am going to ask a question of you. As a longtime lawyer for the NAACP, didn't Judge Ronald L. Ellis, in your opinion, benefit indirectly from millions of dollars sent to the NAACP by charities Madoff managed money for? And if that is so, why is this judge permitted to treat Madoff with kid gloves? Please go to my website and take a look at the man's background. Doesn't this explain to you in part why Madoff is enjoying the comforts of home? Why he is smirking every time he is seen in the streets? Topic number 5 or 6 on the website, which I found last night in the LA Times. The Italian mafia in the Naples area is in a gang fight with Nigerian gangs in Italy. Did you know that? The Via Domitiana is the road built along the Bay of Naples during the Roman Empire, and it plays a big part in this story. But apparently, Nigerians illegally came into this area years and years ago and did labor. They did cheap labor. And the gangs let them in. The Neapolitan mafia, known as the Camorra, intensified its attacks upon these Africans. Why? Because they're no longer laborers. It says, reporting from Castel Volturno, Italy, soaring on cocaine, gun smoking, the Camorra hit squad sped down the road built along the Bay of Naples during the Roman Empire. The Italian gangsters had just killed an arcade owner, and now they were hunting an African drug dealer. Bulky in bulletproof vests, they scanned the dim main drag of this no-man's land by the sea, a 16-mile strip of a town where Naples blends with Nigeria. They saw African prostitutes wearing miniskirts and multicolored braids, a wild night parade of silhouettes posing, strutting, staggering in search of a few euros. The sedan past storefront churches, neon motel signs, and garbage-strewn lots. It stopped at a low white structure housing ob-ob exotic fashions. The Nigerian drug dealer wasn't there, but the Italian gunman opened up anyway, strafing a group of Ghanaians at the store with an AK-47 assault rifle and semi-automatic pistols. Then they fled to a squalid hideout and celebrated with lobster and champagne, leaving behind 6 people dead, 1 wounded, and an uproar that is spreading across Italy. The killings in September, recounted in interviews by senior anti-mafia officials, were gory evidence of a conflict between the Neapolitan mafia known as the Camorra and Nigerian gangsters who play a growing role in Italy's drug and prostitution rackets. It's worth reading the story because it's very unusual. And I linked it up for you on michaelsavage.com. It's a very unusual story. It's not, certainly original to this show. What's original to the show is the judge involved in the Madoff case. To me, this is an example of everything wrong with our legal system. If you take a longtime liberal lawyer like Ronald Ellis, an NAACP lawyer at that, and you connect the dots to the liberal charities whose money was managed and enriched by Madoff, and then, of course, ultimately, allegedly robbed by Madoff, wouldn't it be a reasonable conclusion that Judge Ellis must recuse himself or face an investigation himself? Because even if only some money went from a Madoff-managed charity to the NAACP, this man must recuse himself immediately. Do you agree with me or disagree with me? The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Let us begin in San Diego. Tony, welcome to the Savage Nation. Should the Madoff judge that we've talked about resign or not?
Well, I think he should, Michael, but I remember you said you were in a case where you had a vitamin company and the two lawyers were in cahoots with each other, and it got me to thinking, why can't the prosecuting lawyers be working with the big-time lawyers? Maybe they can get a job later on. Why aren't they pushing?
Well, wait a minute, but the prosecutor is screaming. He's jumping up and down, demanding that Madoff be jailed immediately. You can't accuse this prosecutor of going lightly. He's jumping up and down. The Madoff prosecutor is demanding his immediate arrest and incarceration. They want him in jail. Assistant U.S. Attorney Mark Litt wants Madoff in jail. It's U.S. Magistrate Judge Ron Ellis who's keeping Madoff in his $8, $9 million co-op.
Well, then
so, therefore, I don't think there's any collusion there, by the way. New York, WOR, Steve, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mike. A couple things. First of all, you know, whether we like it or not, Madoff has a constitutional right to bail. He's put up $10 million. He's not charged with murder. We may
Hold
not
on.
Like
Let's
it.
Pause right there. He did not put up $10 million. In fact, he could not meet the terms of bail because none of his relatives would co-sign the $10 million bond. It was then that Judge Ellis changed the rules and said he doesn't have to meet the bond requirement because he couldn't raise the money. He went light on him right there, and he said you can be under house arrest instead. So I disagree with you. Of course we're all entitled to bail, but he didn't even meet his own requirements of bail.
Mike, I think you're wrong. He did put up a substantial amount, but here's the other issue.
Well, wait a minute. I'm not wrong. You're wrong. He was not able to meet the $10 million bond. He could not meet it because his relatives would not co-sign the bond. Well, it was then that Judge Ellis said, okay, I'll take your apartment as part of the bond motion.
Well, that's worth a lot more than $10 million, Mike.
No, actually, they say it's worth 7 to 9.
Okay, well, still, 7 to 9 for somebody who hasn't killed anybody. I understand the risk of flight, but I want to go on to your other issue with respect
to... Somebody who hasn't killed anybody, he allegedly stole $50 billion. How many lives do you think he's killed?
Mike, let him be convicted first, Mike. You want everybody to be fair to you.
Wait a minute, let him be convicted? Didn't he allegedly confess to the FBI that the whole thing was a scam and that he couldn't support it anymore? And he said he's turning himself in because he can't support this anymore? That's what we have been reading. He has not yet said he's innocent. He has not yet said he's an innocent man, has he?
Mike, having done this for many years and represented many people who have given confessions, until they're convicted, I don't take any confession for granted until the case...
Well, of course not, because a man like you would defend a child molester if you could make a few bucks.
That's not fair, Mike. That's
how you make your money. You make your money from the dregs of humanity. So therefore, you think the dregs of humanity are all innocent until proven guilty. And you're saying he didn't kill anybody. How would you explain the $1 million in jewels that he allegedly sent to his relatives while he was out on bond? Do you think that's the mark of a man not continuing to scam the public?
Well, you know, they have frozen some of his assets, I believe, haven't they?
Well, now you're asking a question because you can't answer mine.
Well, I think it's because you don't know all the answers, too, but can I just say...
Well, what more do I need to know than the prosecutor said that they caught the son of a gun mailing $1 million in jewelry, and on top of it all, he sent out two packages to relatives, and they don't even know what the contents were. Wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that this crook is continuing to scam as much money as he can?
Well, what in and of itself, what's illegal about sending jewelry to his family?
Well, when you're under indictment for stealing $50 billion, wouldn't it strike a few questions in your mind?
But, Mike, this is why I'm grateful to live in the United States of America.
That's right, because in the United States of America, with slimy lawyers like you, people can get away with murder itself.
Not fair, Mike. Heaven forbid it.
It is fair. It's because of men like you that the scum of the earth smirk in the streets after destroying lives. It's because of men like you that permit drug dealers, pimps, and you name it, to walk the streets and smirk at people. No, you shouldn't be proud of yourself. You should hate yourself. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I believe the opening of the show speaks for itself, and the lawyer who called the show is a criminal defense attorney, no doubt, who said that, you know, it's a free country and a man is innocent until proven guilty. That's all true. But there are several tiers of legal justice in this country, as we all know, and there's no doubt that Madoff's wealth is insulating him from the normal course of events that would be occurring. And the fact of the matter is, the man said to me that he hasn't killed anyone. Well, I said he's killed thousands of lives. But a friend of mine just emailed me and said he killed 3 people through suicide. He made 3 people kill themselves. So you can say that he is a killer. In other words, he had 3 men kill themselves because of this guy. That's what we know of so far. And that's an interesting point. But he's not going to be tried for their suicide. But I'd like to see a little bit more investigation about Judge Ronald L. Ellis, and the reason is quite clear. It's not because he's a member of the NAACP. It's not because he's a member of the Metropolitan Black Bar Association. It's not because he has worked in the far-left aspect of the law for so many years. It's because I suspect, or I would suspect, let me put it to you that way, or we should reasonably expect that the money that Madoff was making for these charities was flowing in part to the NAACP, and therefore Ronald Ellis's salary itself was probably paid in part at some time by some of the charities that were managed by Madoff's ill-gained earnings. And so, therefore, he must recuse himself. Or it could even be worse. Now, I didn't know who the judge was or what his background was until about 30 minutes ago. It took us all this time to find it. We've been looking for a week. It's well hidden. Normally, you could look up a magistrate judge immediately. We couldn't find it. Well, we found it. No, not the New York Post, not Fox News, not the LA Times, not the Chicago Tribune, not the New York Times, but Michael Savage did so. Now, since I have found this, it's worthy of these better journalistic organs to do a better investigation than I could do in 30 minutes. Don't make any mistake about it. I pray the newspapers in this country survive, because the country will be dead without the newspapers, the big ones, the good ones. It's phenomenally complex and expensive to do a good investigation. We need them desperately. Sure, I'd like to see them less biased. Sure, I'd like to see them to be more objective, but that's a separate story. The fact of the matter is, I'd like to see one of these newspapers pick up the story that we just started with here on the Savage Nation. I don't need the credit for it. I would never get it anyway, but that's not the issue. The issue is justice. Now, if Judge Ellis once was director of the NAACP's Poverty and Justice Program, which focused on issues affecting poor individuals in areas such as school equity, environmental justice, whatever that means, and access to health services, he can surely understand what it would mean to have been robbed by somebody of your life savings. You understand that? And so therefore, Judge Ellis should not be treating Madoff with kid gloves. If you jump the subway turnstile, you go to the tombs for 30 Savage. Days. Well, we read this morning that Madoff, the man behind the alleged $50 billion scandal, was about to send $173 million to friends and family, according to the prosecutors. In a letter sent to federal court today, a prosecutor contends that investigators found $173 million in checks in Madoff's desk that he was about to send to friends, family, and employees. Now, this man is the accused architect of a record-breaking alleged $50 billion Ponzi scheme. He's free on a $10 million bond in a federal securities case, but that means house arrest. Now, on Monday, Manhattan prosecutors asked that his bond be revoked because he allegedly violated an asset freeze by sending valuable jewelry to family members, $1 million worth. The question I am raising today is why he's being treated so gingerly and so much with silk, with silk gloves, silk glove treatment by the judge. The judge is Judge Ellis. We finally found a little connection here that is worthy of investigation by a newspaper. And that is that Ronald L. Ellis, United States Magistrate Judge, Southern District of New York, was for many years on the staff of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Now, unto itself, there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But I allege that many of the charities that Madoff was managing the funds for, these were all extreme left-wing charities, super liberal charities. The money was flowing to liberal organizations and liberal groups. I'm sure some of the money went to the NAACP. On the face of it, this judge must recuse himself. That's without accusing the judge. He must recuse himself. That's my opinion. Now, will this lead be picked up by a newspaper? I doubt it. Do you know why it won't be picked up? Because the NAACP is a sacred cow in the United States of America. This pressure groups, including the NAACP itself, would say that you're a racist for even looking into this. Okay, so there it is. There's the problem. The beauty of being marginalized, as I have been, is that I'm not afraid of that. In other words, once you're marginalized, you can do what you want. So there's an actual freedom in having been marginalized. You'll notice that there are unknown talk show hosts who are, let's rumble on the CNN with talk shows. You never heard of them. You ask yourself, why is Savage not there? Because it's all fake. It's all staged fake. The beauty of having been marginalized by the government media complex is that in a free country, you can still ask questions. So that's what I'm doing. I'm asking questions. That's all. Now, if you want to talk about Madoff, or you want to talk about the other story I touched on, which is the Italian mafia in the Naples area going after Nigerian African gangs, and that there was a hit that left six Africans dead in a drive-by, and what that's all about. It's an interesting story unto itself. It's linked up. It's a great article, by the way. You talk about journalism from the LA Times, and it was written by Sebastian Rotella. What's interesting to me is how well this story was done and what it must have cost to do in dollars and what it must have cost to have written this story, to have researched it, to have gone to Italy, piece it together, and to write a story like that. So before you start celebrating the death of newspapers, you better understand that we're going to lose some phenomenal reporting here, and then where are we going to be then? So I keep saying, sure, I'd like to see more normalcy in the newspapers, but that's going to be a long time in coming. Nevertheless, you can pretty much read between the lines with certain publications and draw your own conclusions, as you can listen to my show and draw your own conclusions. Chicago Anthony, welcome to the show. Which topic are you calling on?
Yeah, I'm calling on the mafia. But first, I would like to say it's too bad the people that are ripped off by Madoff don't have a Don Corleone to go to. But my next point is that as an Italian-American, I'm proud to know that the mafia is finally doing something over there for their people, which they originally did with the Black Hand Gang in Sicily.
Well, but here's the problem. On the face of it, it sounds like the Neapolitan gangsters are defending their home turf against invaders from Africa. Doesn't it sound like that?
Sounds exactly like that.
But that's not what it is, because it was they who brought them in. They're actually their junior partners in drug and prostitution business. Well, and it says this is a message from the Camorra clan aimed at terrifying its junior partners into obedience.
Well, just like how we brought Mexicans into this country legally, we got to get them out. The same principle should apply to Italy.
Well, no, but you're not hearing what I'm saying. Nigerian gangsters were brought in the 1990s because there was a demand for African prostitutes. And it says that Camorra clans rented turf to Nigerian pimps, a line of work that Neapolitan gangsters disdained, so they let the Nigerians do it. And then it says, and as cocaine flows increasingly to Europe through West Africa, Nigerians have graduated from their previous role as smuggling mules and pay the Camorra for a cut of street trafficking action. In other words, the Camorra gang worked well with the Nigerians at first, according to a top Justice Ministry official who led a major prosecution of the Nigerian mafia last year. But he says they were low-cost labor. They were well-received because they were cheap and very loyal. But then the Nigerians started to rise to a new level. In other words, they wanted a bigger part of the action.
Okay. You know, I'm going to go to michaelsavage.com and read the article in full. I'm in my car right now, so that's...
No, that's what I'm saying. I didn't write the article. That's worth reading, though, because you start to see that the story's more complex than it first appears, you know? And that's why it caught my eyes. I mean, we're all interested in seeing Europe become Europe again and European nations defend themselves from hordes of immigrants. But if you read the story, you find out that they were behind the immigrants coming in to begin with because they wanted them involved in the rackets. That's all. 1-800-449-8. See, there's subtlety at the end of the day. I'm not even going to talk about Obama and his plan. It's ludicrous. The most ludicrous part of Obama's plan was the Republicans getting up after him saying he was going to spend nearly $1 trillion to bail out the country, was for John Bonehead from the Republican Party to get up and say, well, we have to watch out for spending. We can't go into deficit spending. We have to watch out for the costs. This is after the Republicans for 8 years have taken the country's economy and run it off the rails with exactly this kind of spending. Are you kidding me? What in the world do the Republicans think they're saying? Who is listening to them? Who would listen to them other than Rush Limbaugh and ditto heads? How could you believe a word of what a Republican says about don't spend too much, Obama? They just burned the economy to the ground like a slash and burn agriculture. They burnt the field to the ground. There's nothing left but ashes. Now, is spending the answer in part, possibly? Is there an answer? No, there is no answer. There are a couple of answers. Cut all government agencies by 20%. Then you say, well, then what are the people going to do for a living? Put them on welfare? I don't know what's cheaper. It may be cheaper to keep them in a government job than it is to put them on welfare. I'm not sure. I don't even know who makes more today, a welfare recipient or a government, a midline or low-level government worker. I'm not quite sure who makes more money. But in either case, what are you going to do? You want people in the streets starving to death? Maybe that's what's going to happen no matter what they do. After all, it was the norm for centuries to have masses of people in the streets begging and masses of people living basically below the poverty line. This concept that everybody should be living at a certain level is a ludicrous form of Soviet-era thinking. It didn't work in the Soviet Union with the government investing itself in every man's life. And it's not going to work in this once capitalist nation. What will work? I don't have an answer for you. I know it'll work for me. You have to figure out what will work for you. New York City, Dan, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Yes, I have no sympathy for super liberals, and I hope they throw the book at Madoff when he gets convicted. But just want to run this by you about that theory you had. Like, these charities no longer can contribute to the NAACP because they've been decimated because of him. And as well, they must be quite angry at him. So if the judge is associated with the NAACP and the charities that have been contributing to his causes now can't do it anymore and have been harmed, would you maybe think, I mean, how would, I'm just throwing that out.
You're a very good thinker. Your logic is impeccable. It's what I love about people who can still think. You're actually concluding the opposite of what I concluded.
So be reason to recuse him, of course.
Well, wait a minute. Even if what you suggest is true, and I don't know, someone would have to investigate it, there's still, the question is still raised as to whether or not Judge Ellis has any money invested with a Madoff group directly. We don't know that. Because a guy like Madoff covered his tracks, his background. A guy like Madoff was so clever in what he did, it seems to me he would have taken money from every judge in New York if he could have, in order to own them. You follow what I'm saying?
That's a whole nother
story. Well, think about what I'm saying. Why wouldn't a guy like Madoff have said, you know, the fund is closed, but Judge X, I'll tell you what, I'm going to let you in. And then the judge made money from him for 10, 12 years or whatever. And maybe he got a word out to him, look, I'll tell you what, if you go easy on me, I'll make sure that you get your money back. I don't know if that went on. But it certainly seems to me that a prosecutor ought to look into whether or not a judge who's being so nice to Madoff has any kind of financial dealings with him at some point.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm just, you know, going at it from the point of view you made about the charities because, you know, in reality, they were quite harmed, and he might be angry about that. But like I said, from my point of view, that kind of wouldn't negate your point, except it would force him to recuse himself from the other side of the coin. So it would still be valid, I guess.
Well, there's another element that just came out, and your thinking is so good, Dan. I'm going to send you a copy of Psychological. Don't go away. Dan, hold it a minute. Dan, I want to know something. I bet that you have an ordinary – well, what do you do for a living?
I like to tell people I'm an unemployed bum, but I've worked throughout my life. You know,
But you can think. That could be why you're unemployed.
I just invest at this point, but not with Madoff.
It could be that you think too well, and that's why you're unemployable.
Well, I'm not unemployable. I just don't work.
Well, no, in the United States of America, if you can think, you're definitely a danger to the power structure. Anyway, Dan, I'm sending you a copy of my book, okay? Stay on the line. Now, here's an article that came out minutes ago. Minutes ago, Madoff victims did the math and realized they profited. You know how you've been telling they're all victims? The many Bernard Madoff investors who withdrew money from their accounts over the years are now wrestling with an ethical and legal quandary. What they thought were profits was likely money stolen from other clients in what prosecutors are calling the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Now they are confronting the possibility they may have to pay some of it back. Did you hear this one? The issue came to the forefront this week as about 8,000 former Madoff clients began to receive letters inviting them to apply for up to $500,000 in aid from the Securities Investor Protection Corp. I want to pause right there. You may not know this, but this is another scam. The SIPC, as far as I know it, should not be permitted to give 1 cent back to any Madoff investor because the SIPC is supposed to not give money back to people who invested in hedge funds. Did you hear what I just said to you? Therefore, why are these people lining up for $500,000 each is not beyond me. It's because this country and this government is totally rotten. Lawyers for Investors have been warning clients to do some tough math before they apply for any funds set aside for the victims and figure out whether they were a winner or loser in the scheme. You may not know this. You know why? Because hundreds or thousands of investors in Madoff's funds have been withdrawing money from their accounts for many years. In many cases, these investors have withdrawn far more than their principal investment. Now listen to what I'm talking about. I had a call yesterday, it says, from a guy who said, I've taken out more money than I originally put in, but I still had $1 million left with Madoff. Should I file a $1 million claim? Said Stephen Caruso, a New York attorney specializing in securities and investment fraud. Caruso added, I'm hard-pressed to give advice in that situation. You follow what I'm saying? So in other words, a guy puts in $1 million. Let's say a person put in $1 million 10 years ago, and every year he made 10%. So he made $100,000 roughly a year. I'm not even doing multiples of the $100,000. I'm not compounding the interest. So over 10 years on the $1 million, he makes $1 million, right? So therefore, he made $1 million over the 10 years. So now he should have $2 million. But what if he only has $1 million left? Can he say he lost $1 million? Should he file $1 million claim? That's the end. No one knows the answer. Among the options, get in line with other victims looking for restitution. Keep quiet and hope nobody notices. Return the money or hire a lawyer, fight to keep profits that were probably fraudulent. You hear this? In other words, a lot of these people are going to wind up being sued because they lived off the money. Jonathan Levitt, a New York attorney who represents several former Madoff clients, said more than half the victims who called his office looking for help have turned out to be people whose long-term profits actually exceeded their principal investment. There are a lot of net winners, he said. Ask for an example. Here's another one. Levitt said one caller whom he declined to name invested $1.8 million with Madoff more than 10 years ago. Okay. Then cashed out nearly $3 million worth of profits as the years went by. On paper, he still had $4.4 million invested with Madoff when the scheme collapsed. But it now looks as if that figure was almost entirely comprised of fictitious profits on investments that were never actually made, leaving his claim to be owed nothing or anything. Now, this is a very interesting subject. It means that Madoff actually made these people money. To me, the question is, where's the money? I'd like to know where the money is. Now, this was a hedge fund that Madoff used. And I want to remind you that you keep reading these sob stories and you keep hearing that each of them is going to apply for up to $500,000 in aid from the Securities Investor Protection Corp, the SIPC. According to my knowledge, the SIPC is not supposed to pay back losers in hedge fund investments. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Therefore, why are they lining up for money? I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. I mean, we're talking more about the Madoff case than about Obama's dangerous selections inside the Justice Department and what it means for our war on terror and how it's going to come to an end. And God forbid that comes to an end, because if it does, our enemies are going to strike us again. But I'll do that at another time. Let's go to the callers. New York, Nancy, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Mike. You know, I really don't have a lot of sympathy for millionaires who can't, you know, are supposed to be smart and don't do their homework or who they're giving their millions to.
Well, I know it's hard to have sympathy for people who are gloating over 10, 12% earnings a year for many years, isn't it?
Greed. They wanted that money, even they didn't care how they got it. And then, you know, I mean, I can't believe someone can, money means.
So that's like putting money on the streets for the vigorous, for, let's say you know somebody who does that. And you can make 12% a year by giving it to a wise guy who puts it out on the streets. And you're going to make 12% a year. What, you're not supposed to know that it comes with blood on it?
I know. I mean, they're supposed to know what they're doing. I mean, come on. I mean, I really
Well, it's not only that, but I want to know why they're going to get a bailout in the form of $500,000 each when that fund, the SIPC fund, specifically excludes hedge funds. These people were living on the gains of a hedge fund. I'm sorry. They gambled and lost. You know, all the years I was hearing about these things, I too said, oh, my God, how come I don't know somebody? How come I can't be making 10% a year of my money? Why am I making a lousy 1 or 2% in the bank or whatever, or your T-bill? How come I can't get in on these things? Well, I'm very lucky I didn't know anybody. You know what I'm saying? But the fact is they got in on it. They enjoyed the profits. Many of them took the profits out and lived on them. So what? Now I'm supposed to feel bad for them? That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Right. And the scam radar would have been right off in my mind right away. I would have been right away thinking there's something wrong here.
Well, I hear you, Nancy. Thanks for calling the show, to be honest with you. Kansas City, Steve, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Dr. Savage, I heard that show on marijuana yesterday, and I thought it was very helpful. Got a lot of clients that smoke it, and I've heard more about vaporization and wondered if you know anything about that and whether or not it's a scam, that it's a much safer way to ingest marijuana.
Now, when you say vaporization, I assume you mean putting it in a glass pipe and smoking it through water, a water pipe?
No, actually, it's a process where there could be a ceramic heating element above the marijuana. The flame never touches it. It heats it up to like 300 to 400 degrees or whatever. Actually creates a vapor that's inhaled, and the vapor is released.
All right, so in other words, if you inhale a vapor, you're not getting the smoke, you're not getting the tar, you're not getting the other direct carcinogenic compounds. You're just getting the cannabinoid THC to get high, in essence, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, then you got to look at the effects of THC itself on the psyche or on the body, as opposed to, let's say, looking at the health effects of the negatives, the tar and the other things I talked about yesterday. Well, if you look at the effects of THC itself, you can see that there is anxiety, panic, paranoia, and feelings of impending doom in many people. That has nothing to do with the tar or the smoke. That's a direct result. Those negative side effects are directly resultant from the THC itself.
I agree with you. Well, keep up the good work, Dr. Savage. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm trying to enlighten people, which leads me to the next question, which will be tied into everything else we talked about in this hour. I understand there are many people in their 20s who listen to this show, and I want to hear from the 20-somethings who actually see this show as a form of rebellion. In other words, the Savage Nation is to them what liberalism was to their parents. That's right. This show is the rebellion that their parents went through.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It's important not to live in the bubble. So you've got to be open to outside information, particularly criticism. I'll tell you, I very rarely read good press. I often read bad press, not because I agree with it, but because I want to get a sense of are there areas where I'm falling short and I can do better.
You haven't gotten a lot of bad press so far.
Yeah, I'm sure it's coming. The markets are obviously a slightly different situation. Right now, given the sensitivities of the market, I've got to pay some attention to market psychology because part of what we have right now is such a loss of trust in both the marketplace and in government that restoring that confidence, restoring that trust is going to be very important.
This effort to get this done was formalized a year and a half ago when John Podesta, who now has a different job, came out with this document. It was the Structural Imbalance for a Political Talk Radio. And it's pretty scathing if you stop and look at it. On page 11, it says, if you don't do, talking about station owners, if you don't do as we tell you to do in terms of addressing the content, quote, if commercial radio broadcasters are unwilling to abide by these regulatory standards, a spectrum fee should be levied on owners to directly support local, regional, and national public broadcasting. Now, that's enough to put the fear of God into anyone who's out there in this business. And I look at this really as intimidation, not as what is going to happen.
All right. Well, now, what I did was I opened with Obama saying it's important not to live in a bubble. You've got to be open to criticism. And I really hope that he remembers that when the little people, the mini brains like Barbara Boxer, try to pass the fairness doctrine. When the Lilliputians, the hags, the Harridans, the frightened people, the liars, the thieves, the charlatans in Congress, try to pass the fairness doctrine to shut down the savage nation. I only hope that President Obama remembers the opening of Clip 9, which he gave today. And I want you to just play the beginning again to Clip 9, because we're going to hold.
Important.
Wait a minute. We're going to hold President Obama. I have no reason to doubt him, by the way. I actually believe he believes this. The question is, can Obama's idealism pass muster with the mini brains like Senators Boxer? Listen.
I think it's important not to live in the bubble. So you've got to be open to outside information, particularly criticism. I'll tell you, I very rarely read good press. I often read bad press, not because I agree with it, but because I want to get a sense of, are there areas where I'm falling short?
All right. Now, I pray to God that President Obama, incoming President Obama, means what he just said. He sounds like he does. He's a very good salesman if he doesn't. But I'm going to take him on his word. And he says you've got to be open to criticism. He rarely reads good press. He only reads bad press to see if, not that he agrees with it, but to see where he might be failing. And yet you have mini brains like Boxer, Feinstein, if I remember, there were even some so-called Republicans who want to control conservative talk radio. And that's going to come up very, very soon when they try to pass what is, in essence, censorship. And I want to see who wins, whether it's the Obama wing, the idealistic Obama wing, or the throwback Mussolini wing of the Democrat Party. We're also talking about the scam artist, Madoff, the alleged Ponzi scheme manipulator. And we went and did some research because we could not understand why the man is being treated with kid gloves. And I've been saying, who's Judge Ellis? Who's Judge Ellis? Who's Ron Ellis? And without suggesting any wrongdoing, I believe that there's enough of a link between the funds that Madoff managed, that is the charities, and the NAACP, and the judge, Judge Ellis, who worked for the NAACP for 30-some-odd years or so until he became a federal magistrate judge, for the judge to immediately recuse himself. That's my opinion. And I want you to go to michaelsavage.com because we're the only ones in the media who have it. Since I do not exist, I doubt that it will appear on any other website. And you'll see Madoff judge exposed. That's not accusing him of anything, but something's wrong with this picture as far as I am concerned. And I'd like you to look at that and discuss it or any other topic that you would like. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. I also asked 20-somethings to listen to the show, and I'll tell you why. I have been told that there's a whole group of 20-somethings who are rebelling against the liberal pap that they are fed by the newspapers, the liberal pap that they have been fed in college, the liberal pap that they have been spoon-fed from the time they went into school. And many of these people were raised in single-parent homes, mainly single women. They did not have a father figure around. And I have been told that for thousands of these people, I have become their radio father. It doesn't mean that they eat up everything I say. It doesn't mean that they think I'm the greatest person on earth. But it means that they're getting something from me or things from me that they're not getting out there in the other part of the world, and they're desperate to hear other opinions. And so I invited 20-somethings to call the Savage Nation and comment upon this. Let's begin in San Francisco, where you would assume anybody in their 20s has green hair, body rings and whatnot, and they're all super libs. San Francisco, KNEW, Zeb, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Michael Savage. I just want to let you know that I greatly appreciate you and your show and your knowledge. I've been listening to you about every day for the last 5 years, and it drives me crazy that most of my peers seem like they don't know what's really going on. And when I go to work every day and work 12 hours a day, you know, I don't have an opportunity to read a newspaper or watch the news. So I sit down at work and I listen to you, and I feel like, you know, I'm more in touch than I would be if I hadn't listened.
Right. You're getting, look, you're getting one man's opinion. First of all, I'm selecting the stories that I think are of interest to me, or else I can't do it. The first rule of talk radio is that it has to interest the host and excite the host. You know, there are stories that are bigger than Madoff in a way. But they're not of any interest to me. Madoff has a certain element, has many elements to it that interest me. It goes to many, many issues that I'm interested in. But even the pot show yesterday, the marijuana, the dangers of pot, was of great interest to me, because I think so many millions of kids are being misled into thinking that because it's natural, it's good for you. So I'm glad you listened to the show, and I would also encourage you to try to follow the news in other ways as well. Zev, I'm sending you a copy of Psychological Nudity. Please bring it to work and make sure that others take a look at it. Sacramento, Nick, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. It's an absolute honor to speak to you. And I had to call in once you brought that case point up. I mean, you say that it's just one man's opinion. I like to think of it as one man voicing the opinion of many more who don't have the ability to do such.
I understand. I do understand that. Trust me. You know, in my daily life, let me start from the top. I don't have any friends. I don't know how many people really do at a certain age in their life. I think that unless you're involved in a fraternal group or a church group or a religious group or a charity, most of us don't have many friends, because it's not a society built upon friendships. It's a society where we are all atomized and we live alone by and large, you know, with our own family. So the people that I talk with from day to day, or in and out, maybe waiters, roofers, plumbers, electrician, gardeners, maids, a grocer, you know what I'm saying? And I kind of get my feedback of the world from the man in the street in that regard. That's where I draw some of my conclusions from, in addition to my own background and biases, as reflected upon in my comments upon the news of the day. But don't assume that this is an objective show, because it isn't, Nick. It really is one man's opinion. The interesting part is, though, millions upon millions of people seem to draw the same conclusions that I do, only they're never heard from.
I couldn't agree more.
Thanks, Nick. I appreciate it. 1-800-449-8255. Indianapolis, Brian, from the middle of America. You're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Well, Michael, nice to talk to you this evening. Just wanted to let you know that there's a really big double standard in the country amongst liberals and young conservatives. People like myself, I work hard every day. I'm young, I have a family. And other young people, they don't want to see my viewpoint or hear my viewpoint at work or in public. And it just seems that we're very much alienated from the rest.
Oh, absolutely. Well, once you have a family, Brian, by and large, you are single friends and you see the world entirely differently. They can never understand the world. I've said it before, the dividing line between people is when you see your child's eyes come out of the womb. That changes the entire universe. When you see one of your children come out of the womb, your whole world changes. Am I right or wrong?
You live for them and their interests.
That's right. You live for that little, innocent, weak, precious creature. That's what you live for. And you do so for the rest of your life if you're a sane parent.
It changed my life. It saved my life.
Well, it does. That's right. And how could a single person ever understand that? They may be nice people. They may have intellect to comprehend what you're saying, but they don't actually understand it from a visceral point of view. The protective nature of being a parent changes your whole view of the world.
Yes. I had never owned a gun or possessed a gun until I had my two small children and my wife to defend, and I had to make sure that I came home every night from work in a tough job, and the only thing that I could do to protect myself was, you know, get my permit that I could conceal and carry in Indiana. That's the law. And every night I make sure that I lock it away to where my children can't get to it, but where I can get to it if somebody tries to hurt my family or myself. And that
is your constitutional right. Let's see if the liberals permit you to retain your right to protect your family. I kind of doubt it. I think they're going to assault guns within. It's not the first thing on their agenda. The first thing on the liberal agenda will be gays in the military, because Obama has to pay back the gay billionaires who put him in office. That'll be the first thing you're going to see that's going to send shockwaves throughout America. It's going to be the biggest thing that happens, and it's going to be one of the first things. He's got to pay back Katzenberg and the others in Hollywood who were the first in, and they demand their pound of flesh, I can guarantee you. But I can also guarantee you, Brian, they're going to come after the Second Amendment as well.
Well, we need
Brian, let me send you a copy of Psychological Nudity. It's like Crazy Eddie today. I'm just going to give them away all day today. You know, again, I think it's a book that you're going to read to your children. But I want to go back to the children thing for a minute. Many people listening would think, oh, that guy is crazy. You know, it's a laughable call. Why does he need a gun to protect his family? I want you to run through a scenario in your house. You're home with your wife and two little infant children. And you have only a few seconds to react to someone kicking your front door in. Now, what in the world is a 9/11 call going to do? I love these ads you call Brink Security. I have nothing against Brink Security. I recommend it highly. They don't even advertise as a line of defense. But I love to see the ads, the white woman calling. She's alone with the children. Hello? Someone broke in. And it's inevitably a good-looking white male actor. Don't worry, ma'am. Help is on the way. Are you kidding me? By the time they say help is on the way, your throat's slashed and you're dead. The only help is on the way is Mr. Smith and Mr. Wesson. Preferably Mr. Remington is even better. I'll be right back.
Savage.
My many faceted jewel of a mind is on to another topic already. You know, that's the problem. Is if I was a tenth of a carat stone like most in the business, I could stick to one topic and think it's brilliant. But because I have a 100 carat brain with many, you know, aspects to it, I truthfully move from point to point, sometimes a little too rapidly. But I want to move on to another story for a moment. If you're holding on any of the other topics, please do. This just came up on Drudge. I saw it earlier, but I chose not to talk about it, but I may as well. Obama can't prepare to talk to Hamas. Incoming administration will abandon Bush's isolation of Islamist group to initiate low-level diplomacy, say transition sources. I'm all for it. I mean, I never understood why you couldn't talk to them. I mean, they're not going to get anywhere. I know exactly what's going to come of it. Obama's like a babe in the woods. You know, after all, the guy is sort of a naive idealist, left-winger. Probably a decent man. I don't think he's an evil man at all. I never said he was. I never thought he was. I think he's a classic liberal lawyer from Chicago. But if he's going to talk to Hamas and then he's going to talk to Iran, then he's going to talk to Cuba, I say great, talk to them all. So it's not a matter of whether you talk to these groups. The question is, who will you send to talk with these groups? Because if you send some lame brain moron left winger who's going to be spun around by these guys who are much smarter than them, they're going to perceive weakness. And what are you going to get out of it? I don't mind contacts with Hamas or Iran. I think it's a good idea. I don't see anything wrong with it as long as he uses intelligent, strong people. God forbid he starts using hacks like Madeleine Albright. You know, the worst case scenario is we have the equivalent of England, 1939, Prime Minister Chamberlain going to talk to Chancellor Hitler. And he comes back and he says he has peace at hand. Listen to this.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement...
All right, we got it. Now, this is Prime Minister Chamberlain on the brink of World War II. He has a meeting with Hitler. He comes back glowing, talking about a peace deal between Germany and England. The Anglo-German relations have never been better, and he's celebrating it. All the while, Hitler was planning war against England. And this is what I fear could happen with Obama... talking with Hamas. Hamas is not a big enough player, but let us say talking with Iran, you know. And so let's wait and see. Let's pray that these left-wingers in the Obama administration know some of their history, including the history of Chamberlain talking to Hitler, or else we're going to see a disaster on the order of what happened to Chamberlain and Chamberlain's group in England. They were roundly embarrassed by this. They never recovered from it. And the same thing could happen here with the Obama liberals, if they don't know their history, because as Santayana, the great Spanish philosopher, wrote, those who do not know their history are condemned to repeat it. I kind of doubt that the Obama administration is very keen on knowing their own history. my guess is they don't know their history. They certainly don't know the history of liberals being duped by dictators. And I believe there's going to be a toxic scenario for Obama by giving legitimacy to the Hitler of Iran and to Hamas. But let's wait and see.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, and I live in the most left-wing city in the United States of America, I'm proud to say, because I hate them. I hate the government of the city more than you could imagine. I think they all should be locked up for malfeasance, for corruption, for permitting a homicide epidemic to get out of control, for so many things that it makes my life pleasant just to wake every day and see the latest outrage against the public sentiment. And what happened now is the so-called Board of Supervisors now elected someone even further to the left than the last lunatic. And the city government, which was already leaning to the left, has become even more liberal. So there it is. San Francisco has now moved even further to the left than it was in the last 20 years, which is good because I know what's going to come next, which is going to be taxation. There's no question in my mind that the far-left morons who run San Francisco, most of whom never earned a dime in their own life that wasn't taken either through graft or plugola or payola or through some couldn't run a hot dog stand, so to speak. These people have never held a job, most of them. The only thing they understand is taxing those who perform a function that people want or provide a product that, that people want. I'm pretty sure that the next thing that's going to come in San Francisco and possibly in your city, is a city income tax, which is that if you work in the city, not even if you don't even live there, let's say you live in a surrounding suburb of a city, they're going to put a 1% income tax upon you in order to pay for their absurd liberal programs. In other words, to make sure the illegal alien goes to bed with a full stomach every night and a free education. So there it is. I mean, from the local to the national to the international, there's no limit to what we can be talking about here in the Savage Nation. We move from Madoff and the judge on michaelsavage.com. Take a look at it. You decide. I love Fox News says we report, you decide. I say I decide, you report. Because at the end of the day, they're really deciding for you just by what they're reporting on. And then they're making you think you're deciding. But in fact, all news organizations decide what you should be reading. And in so doing, they're deciding what you should be concluding. Don't make any mistake about it. I'm just more upfront about it. I am biased. It's one man's opinion. I've told you that before. I try to use Aristotelian logic. I try to use facts, and I try to convince you that my positions are valid. But the fact is, it's simply my opinion. That's all. It's as simple as that. New York City, WOR. Tom, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Michael. Michael, Bernard Madoff with the money should be denied bail because he's a severe flight risk. He could get in his G5 and fly away and never to be seen or heard from again.
Yeah, well, you know that. I know that. But the judge, apparently Judge Ellis, doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Judge Ellis thinks that putting him in his $9 million co-op is a punishment, making him wear an electronic bracelet as he gets up in the morning and goes to his cappuccino machine.
Yeah, if he leaves, he's going to have real pie in his face, you know, if he takes off.
Well, but a guy like Madoff, where could he really run and get away with it? You think this guy can really get away with running somewhere? I don't think so. Come on, let's be real.
Any country that doesn't have an extradition treaty, and anywhere.
Okay, where's he going to go, to Paraguay?
Anything looks good to him right now, right?
Where could he go? Where could Madoff go and get away with no extradition? What's he going to try, the Hyman Roth thing in Israel?
I think there are a lot of countries.
That's just what Israel needs right now, is a gonif like Madoff arriving in his G5 and seeking asylum. That's just what Israel needs for the world's opinion. Do you remember the Hyman Roth character in The Godfather? Do you remember that one at all? Do you remember that far back?
No, I don't.
Oh, it's a great tale. I'm sorry, too many references in my mind from that movie. For some reason, I'm fixated on it. And I admit it. I remember when it came out in 1971, 72, my father had died in 70. I was living in Honolulu at the time, and I remember they were talking about The Godfather was going to come out, and I kept thinking, I wish my father was alive to watch this, because in many ways, the time sequence from when Don Corleone came over at Ellis Island as an immigrant all the way through when he died of a heart attack when he was 55 years old, was when my father died, was almost like the same years. You know what I'm saying? My father lived through it. Not that my father was at all involved in that world. He was a small shopkeeper, his own little shop. But in many ways, from the streets, the cobblestone, the push carts, the vegetable stands, the staging, to me it reminded me every time I watched it of watching like the history of my own father on the legitimate side of that story. And for many reasons, it resonates with me, you know. But in that movie, The Godfather Trilogy, the third was a stinker. I won't go into why. Andy Garcia did a fairly good job, but it was just not realistic. And in that sequence, remember when the character who played Meyer Lansky, Hyman Roth, tries to, it was in GF2, I think. He goes to Israel to try to seek asylum, and they catch him at the airport. Do you have that piece, guys? Play it now. Back to the callers. San Francisco, KNEW. Michael, welcome to the program.
Mr. Savage, you're a genius, I have to tell you. I've just been starting to listen to you lately.
I am a genius, and there's no question. You know, being a genius comes with its negatives as well, I have to tell you that. It's not easy being a genius.
No, because I'm not anything near that. Anyhow, I've been here all my life, San Francisco. I know what you're talking about. It's falling apart.
Falling apart. I swear to you, Michael, I went downtown the other day to a place called Tommy's Joint, which I happen to like, you know, a sandwich, is a lot of tourists, a lot of local. You know, it's down in a seedier part of town. The amount of bums outside the door in that area begging got me sick. There should be a city police car outside that area keeping them away, shooing them away. There's a park down there near the Embarcadero, the financial district, where the green parrots congregate. It's filled with bums who smoke dope. They smoke crack. They're sleeping in the park. They're crapping in the park. There's not a cop to be seen. Why is that?
It's horrible. I don't know. It's falling apart. I can't go into the city anymore. I love it. I can't go in there anymore. I tell you, 20 years ago, the city was full of people like you, sir. I'm telling you. They were beautiful.
Well, it's a funny thing, but when I first moved to San Francisco in 1974, I ran into a lot of people who used to live in the Richmond district, which was largely Irish at that time. And I was stunned to find out that the Irish of San Francisco, the native San Franciscans from the Richmond district, had almost the same accent that I, an original New Yorker, have. Would you believe that?
You know what's funny? A lot of people used to always tell me, think I was from New York. I don't think I have anything near like a New York accent.
No, it's amazing to me. How could somebody with an authentic San Francisco background sound like they're from New York? You don't even realize that. But today, most of the people in San Francisco weren't born here. They come from Topeka or somewhere in the Midwest, and they ran away from their parents to show that they're wild and free. You know, then they became sexually wild, and they dye their hair, and they put on a nose ring, and they think that they're wild and they're far out. But the fact is they're just provincial kids who really have no idea what world they're living in. Thank you for the call, my friend. I have no idea what that call was about, but I'm glad I had it, because it was a fallback from not having the Godfather Hyman Roth piece, which I was told I had waiting for me an hour ago. Boston, WRKO, Rich, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Yeah, hey, Mike, I just wanted one caveat to your marijuana piece, and I hope you keep that webpage up a while so we can download it.
Yes, Art, please keep it up a long time on the medical dangers of marijuana. It's a great one.
The one tidbit that I felt was missed is that when kids do this dope, it disables the vomit reflex. They can drink a whole lot more, and they can blow a 2.5, a 2.8, and go out drinking and driving. And it's a greater hazard because of that.
Why can they drink more if they're on dope?
Well, the marijuana disables the vomit reflex. I don't know why.
Which reflex does it disable?
Chemo patients, so that they don't feel as nauseous.
Oh, it fights nausea. Which is why AIDS and cancer patients like it from the chemo.
Exactly.
So it suppresses the nausea reflex, and consequently the kids drink more when they're on dope? I didn't even know that.
And then you'll see that they'll be able to, you know, hold a lot more alcohol.
Rich, that's brilliant. How did you come to know this?
hanging around with a guy, Mike Savage.
No, come on. No, no, how did you know that it suppresses the nausea reflex and figure out that that enables them to drink more?
Read it somewhere, just like you. You pick up tidbits and put
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I know what you mean. You don't even remember where you caught it, but that's brilliant. That's a great argument against marijuana's legalization, by the way.
Huge.
From all of the people who are pushing the medical uses of marijuana, they're saying, well, it suppresses nausea from the use of chemo. It does. So since it does it for that, it'll also do it for alcohol. I didn't put two and two together, Rich, like you.
Well, when you're in Newport, cup of coffee sometime. I'll see you later. You take care.
Yeah, thank you. When I'm in Boston with a cup of coffee, you say Boston. I have instant memories, the years that I was in Boston. When was I in Boston? Let me do a run, a mental run. I'm thinking of a graveyard. I don't know. Everything's come back. Boston Common Graveyard, 1965. Walking the streets, inhaling diesel fumes near Harvard Square, in Cambridge, near Harvard, the Cambridge Square there. Looking at the tombstones from the 1700s that were sunken into the ground. R.I.P., you know, the whole deal. And thinking, wow, this sucks, man. The fumes are bad here. I got to get out of here. Next, speed forward, 1973. I'm at Harvard for the winter studying to do a book at the Arboretum out in the Jamaica Plains because I was writing a book on trees. And I was living in Marblehead, Massachusetts. I rented the Triangle House, the Anvil House, right underneath the town hall. I love that house because, well, again, it was a house from the 1700s. It was a Revolutionary War era house. I love New England architecture. To this day, I miss it. Living in California where architecture leaves you kind of limp there. In Northern California, there's all ersatz architecture. There's nothing authentic here other than clapboard chicken coop type of houses in Sonoma. Everything else is a mock this or a mock that, a mock Tudor, a mock, whatever. Not bad. Some of them are nice. In L.A., you got some gorgeous mansions. But you go to New England and those houses. So I'm living in the Triangle House, and it was one of the snowiest winters of modern times. And I remember standing on the point at Marblehead, Massachusetts, looking out at the sea in a snowstorm and just shaking my head in wonderment as I was shivering, imagining the men who set forth in sailing ships, either to go whaling or whatever, to carry goods around the world. I couldn't understand how the predecessors on this continent, or in fact in Europe, could get up every day and go to work, so to speak. I don't know how they did it. I just had no idea how they could do it. How could you put a ship out into that water, I wondered, as I walked back to the house for a hot cup of cocoa or whatever it was. But, I mean, I love Boston. Boston was a beautiful city. But like San Francisco, it was once a beautiful liberal city. Both cities were once beautiful, tolerant cities that have devolved into the most intolerant cities in America. And now I know that that sounds paradoxical, but remember, liberalism is not tolerant. Liberalism is extremely intolerant. That's the most important thing for you to remember. They do not tolerate any sort of debate. They do not tolerate any sort of dissension. They are the exact opposite of what they pretend to be to themselves. Ask anybody who lives in these cities who has a point of view that's a little different. Now, I have the Hyman Roth clip ready. I don't think it's going to have to make any sense right now after the Boston diatribe. Let's hear it for the minute anyway. Go ahead.
I'm a retired investor on a pension. I went to Israel because I wished to live there as a Jew in the twilight of my life.
I'm laughing only because it's eerie. And I'm sure that we could wake up any morning now and see Madoff being forced to come back from Israel when they don't accept him, his asylum request. And he's caught at LaGuardia or JFK or Teterboro coming off his jet. And he'll say this now. Let's hear it again.
I'm a retired investor on a pension. I went to Israel because I wished to live there as a Jew in the twilight of my life.
I went there on a pension. Bernie, are you listening in your co-op? You got an opportunity. You could say you're a retired investor living on a pension, and you went to Israel to live there in the twilight of your years. Bernie, baby, go for it. I'll be right back. Savage. I'm not not going to go on and on about liberals and liberal bashing. I wrote the book on it, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. It's the classic. Everyone's copied me. Fine. It's a whole industry. It's pointless. But I want to go back to something I said earlier, Boston and San Francisco being once liberal cities that have become the opposite without even understanding it. Let me give you an example. Here we're reading in the local newspaper about the appointment to this board of supervisors in San Francisco of a Chinese guy. And he's, of course, another liberal. But I want you to listen to this paragraph for a minute. It says he is the first Chinese American to lead the left-leaning 11-member body, which is now made up of a diverse group that includes Asian Americans, including one Asian American woman, gay men, multiples, Latinos, an African American woman, a disabled woman, and a Persian man. And they don't even understand that when they say it's a diverse group, that there's no diversity on the group. There's no political diversity. This is a city, after all. It's not a poster. In other words, if it's diverse, then you should have some conservatives, some moderates, and liberals. So they're all liberals or communists or outright traitors, and they call it diverse because they're Asian, Latino, gay, African-American, disabled, and Persian. You hear this? This is an example of liberal stupidity to the nth degree, which is why I love living here. It's why I love living here. People used to say to me, how can you take it? How can you tolerate it? How can you stand it? I keep referring to Voltaire. Voltaire, the great French writer. They used to say to him, Voltaire, how can you live in Paris with the foolishness of the Parisians? And he would say, that's the reason I live here. I make a living writing about the absurdity of the Parisian. So that's why I stay in Paris, he said. And people shook their head and said, okay, if you could do it. So you say, why am I in San Francisco? First of all, I love the environment, the buildings, the light. There's a certain light here. You have to understand it. I'm a boater, so I love the bay. The interesting part is here, my guess is the diverse 11-member body of the San Francisco supervisors, including the mayor, I doubt that 20% of them have ever been on San Francisco Bay other than on a ferry on a fundraiser. That's number one. I'm not saying I'm, you know, Mr. Sailor here, but I'm on the bay quite often with my boat, and I understand the bay. And if you don't know the bay, you don't know San Francisco at all. It's a marine environment. I love marine environments, so the only place I could ever live would be in a marine environment. It's funny. If I'm walking around the city, even if I walk through Chinatown or North Beach, the Italian district, which I love, it's only when I get closer to the bay and I feel the cool air whipping off the bay, the salt smell, is I actually come alive. I'm that kind of plant. I can't live too far from the water. But that's my own problem. It's not your problem. But again, getting back to the main point, here is an example of the blindness of liberalism on a local level, but it's going to be no different with the Obama administration and the folks in the media who worship them. They write a thing like this. He's the first Chinese American to lead the left-leaning 11-member body, which is now made up of a diverse group that includes Asian Americans, including one Asian American woman, gay men, plural, Latinos, an African American woman, a disabled woman, and a Persian man. Is there a conservative amongst them? Of course not. Is there a white male conservative married? No. What do you mean diverse? It is not a diverse group. It's a very polarized, doctrinaire, left-wing group that's made up of people who look like they're diverse. That's America's problem in a nutshell, right here in San Francisco. Here is a city with bums all over the streets. Here is a city with a homicide epidemic out of control. Here is a city with manifest problems that could be solved rapidly if we truly had a diverse group running the city. But we don't. The city has been taken over by a gang a long time ago, a gang of left-wing shysters, all of whom should be investigated by the FBI, in my opinion. In the next hour, I'm going to be speaking with Kyle Ann Shiver about the increasing liberal disillusionment with Barack Obama. That's right. You actually haven't heard me criticize Barack Obama, have you? No, it's the far left wing of the Democrat Party and the jerks who worshipped him who are actually disillusioned with him because he isn't far enough to the left. The Bill Ayers wing of the party is extremely PO'd with Barack Obama. I hope Obama means what he said when he said you got to be open-minded and listen to your critics. I want to see if he really means it when Big Chin Pelosi says we want the fairness doctrine, or when little brain boxer parrots the same thing that Big Chin Pelosi says. This is the Savage Nation. Be here or be on michaelsavage.com. There's nowhere else to be.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We're going to be doing several big projects ahead of the inauguration. This is just one of them, actually. And, you know, it really has to do with all of the sort of the inspired art that we've seen a lot of around the Obama campaign and also the historic presidential win. You're going to love this. This is from Jason Dooley. He's a 27-year-old graphic design student at Georgia State University. This is a topography project. And the concept was inspired by the movie poster, The Passion of the Christ, where, you know, to him, he wanted to create something that depicted pressure, strength, and uncertainty all within one image. And, you know, the way he did this, if you look closely, he used several layers of handwritten type. Including passages from the Bible, campaign speeches, and from Julius Caesar.
The Passion of Obama. The Passion of the Obama. The media's fawning obsession with Obama is reaching a fever pitch as his inauguration approaches. CNN even ran a piece on artists depicting Miss Jesus. If you're a liberal, have you become sick of the incessant sycophantic slobbering over Obama, an ordinary man? If you're a conservative, what's the most inane thing that you've seen an Obama acolyte say or do to honor his idol? Who in the media has most shamelessly kissed up to the Obama action figure? For all their claims of free thinking, open-mindedness, and rejecting the restraining social mores of the past, liberals are actually very closed-minded individuals for the most part. They get an idea into their heads like government control of the economy or multiculturalism, or if it feels good, do it. And once they get one of these ideas into their heads, they pursue it with a destructive monomania that puts the most crazed inhabitants of a psych ward to shame. One of these ideas is anything that is organic or comes from the earth is automatically good for you. It's an idea that has a kernel of truth, like most of the ideas that liberals follow slavishly. After all, who would want pesticides in their food? Organic is better. Who would want artificial flavorings or colorings? Natural is better. Who would want artificial stimulants when you can get them straight from the earth? Natural is better. But a perfect example of how liberals carry these ideals too far is marijuana. Liberals assume that since marijuana comes from the earth, since marijuana is a plant, since marijuana is natural and organic, since it's green, that it must be good for them. Of course, hemlock also comes from the earth and is a deadly poison, but that doesn't matter to them. Of course, arsenic is another dangerous poisonous substance that the earth produces, but liberals don't care about that either. Of course, ricin comes from the earth, and that can kill you in a smaller dose as micrograms. In addition to these and dozens of others, they ignore the multiple dangerous toxic chemicals that they take into their bodies when they smoke a joint. They write songs about it. They make movies and TV shows joking about it, all as they shorten their lives and deaden their brains with this addictive substance. But as usual, the potheads are not interested in the facts. They have latched onto the idea that pot is good because it's natural. After all, their parents did it. They know lots of other people that do it, and they're all living. That's because they live in an insular ideological world. A world where the ideas of others who believe what they believe in are more important than medical facts. And so the idea that pot is good and won't have a negative effect on their lives seems self-evident to them. But in fact, the monomaniacal self-rationalizing mental disorder that is liberalism, caused in part by potism, is slowly killing them and slowly bringing our society down as well.
Driving that train, high on cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And know that notion just crossed my mind.
Now we can move on. I have an old friend I haven't seen in many years. I knew him very well. Gee, God, it's a long time ago. When I was a young graduate student, he was a professor, and he's an expert in, let's just say, tropical diseases. We'll leave it generic. So to make a long story short, I recontacted my old friend, and we talked. Politically, we're on the opposite sides of the spectrum. But here's the point of the story. I want to read you the I sent him my book, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder, and he sent me his, and I just got it today by overnight mail. I won't read you the title of his book, but I want to read you the inscription. It says, to Michael, separated by geography and maybe some political philosophy, but as always, my cherished friend. I think it was one of the most beautiful inscriptions I've ever read in my life. And all of the friendship that I enjoyed with this man and his wife of many years ago came flooding back into my memories, the pictures of the children when they were young and the fun we had. I could still hear the man laughing. Would you believe it? And it just shows you that although you can disagree with someone politically, you don't have to hate them. That's the interesting story. In fact, when I jokingly said to him on the phone, we talked, and he knows I'm this flaming right winger, you know, and he said something to the effect, he said, well, I'm still a liberal. I said, well, I know you're in the cloister, the ivory tower. He says, yes, that's probably the reason. He says, I refuse to grow up. But he said it in such a way that I was relieved and laughed. He said it in a way that disarmed me. I didn't have to hate him. And nor did he have to hate me and call me Hitler for being a right-winger. You understand what I'm saying to you or not? You get it? Reasonable people can violently disagree politically, but they don't kill each other. Maybe I'll have him on the show. I don't want to, you know, give up. I haven't seen him in years. So many good memories, you know, all from one inscription. How is a man write such a... To Michael, separated by Teddy, stop it. My dog is acting up again. To Michael, separated by geography and maybe, comma, some political philosophy, comma, but as always, my cherished friend. And that was beautiful. I hope he's listening to the show. I don't even know if he listens there in Crackerville where he lives. I, Michael Savage, will be right back.
Savage.
There's no doubt that in this last election, Obama was the chosen one by the left-wing media. He was placed on a pedestal so high that not even the Clinton political machine could knock him off the pedestal. But now as Obama gets ready to take office, oh boy, most of his cabinet choices are making him appear less like the messiah of change and more like a regular old-time politician, thank God. Our next guest is Kyle Ann Shiver with Pajamas Media, where she's written an article describing the gravest threat to Obamaland, which is disillusionment. Kyle Ann Shiver, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on again.
What do you mean by disillusionment in this case?
Well, I thought probably the most memorable video during the entire campaign season was a lady who was interviewed right after Obama spoke at a big rally and said that she could not wait for him to get in because then she was never going to have to worry about paying her mortgage or putting gas in her tank ever again. And so that's, I think, the nugget that spells out what people are expecting from President Obama. The problem with making all those promises and seeming to walk on water when you really can't is that people tend to expect you to be able to follow through. And so if you've ever seen anybody in the throes of disillusionment, I don't know. I'm not sure it's going to be all that pretty.
What about some of his choices for the cabinet?
You know, I think the Hillary Clinton appointment is, to me, it was just, I'm sure that was a deal they made beforehand. If you're elected, I get this, and it'll be, it'd be a great place. to make another run for the presidency if Obama happens to put his foot in it during this first 4 years. And, you know, for the Clintons to get out on the campaign trail when they clearly were not very excited about it, and I think there were still a lot of sour grapes there. I saw that as a very cynical appointment, and if I had been one of his very fervent followers, I don't think I would have thought that was too wonderful. Well, that just leads right into my favorite appointment so far, has to be the education secretary. It's the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. So, this guy, Arnie Duncan, does anybody remember all the just foaming at the mouth that people did when George W. appointed people from Texas to be in his cabinet? I mean, it was just excruciating to listen to. Well, now Obama has picked the CEO of the Chicago schools when the governor is under, you know, such a cloud. And this guy was a Daley appointment. He was appointed by the corrupt Mayor Daley. He's presided over the Chicago public schools for the last 7 years. They are one of the worst school systems in the country as far as outcomes go. And he's a member of the Obama Club. He was brought up in Hyde Park. He lives in Hyde Park now. He went to Harvard. He was the president of the Harvard Club in Chicago among the alumni. So we're talking about a real inside pick, and to me, this is the worst one of the lot.
We seem to be back to the I'll scratch your back if you scratch my type of politics.
Oh, yes, of course. And, you know, I think it's so telling that during the election season, our mainstream media sent hordes, literally, of reporters and investigators to Alaska to dig up every single little shred of anything they could find on Sarah Palin, yet Chicago was left absolutely unperturbed. And Chicago is, you know, the one thing I remember from my fourth grade civics lesson was that the most infamous machine in American political corruption was Chicago and Mayor Daley, and now his son is still doing the same thing. I just find it absolutely funny. If it weren't so serious, it would be hilarious.
Well, Obama's choice for Secretary of Education doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
Well, I've always felt there was a disconnect, you know, among liberal politicians on that score. And I think their main problem is that they're so in bed with the teacher unions that they really, you know, they want to talk a good game on reforming our public schools, but the unions are the biggest obstacle to that reform, and so they're left with the glossy, lovely rhetoric when it comes down to, we know they're failing. We know they're terrible. I'm sure there are some good public schools, but I know a lot of teachers, and they are so handicapped by the paperwork and the directives coming out of the education czar's office that there's not a lot of time left for teaching. I think the biggest, loveliest example right now of Obama just being another wily, shrewd politician, no light worker, you know, as he's been described, is this education appointment. Because what is really sad, I don't know if you remember ever hearing of Marva Collins. She was the extraordinary educator who took children from very disadvantaged backgrounds, very socioeconomically disadvantaged, and turned them into star students. Her school is in Chicago. She has numerous books on how she was able to take these children and turn them into magna cum laudes from Harvard. I mean, that's what she's done. She's right there in Chicago. If Barack Obama really wanted to do what he says he wants to do in education, he could have picked her for the education czar. She just had to close her school because of lack of funding. She never took any state funding for her schools because the Chicago schools would not let her use her extraordinary methods that were successful. I think that's one of the saddest, and as a mother, one of the most sickening things I've ever seen.
What about the big promise from Obama on how the world is going to be friendlier now?
I think part of that is he's probably depending on this worldwide media network that is owned and operated by one of his major donors, George Soros. Soros owns about 300 media outlets worldwide. So he feeds the same storyline from that Open Society Institute. They feed the same storyline. For the last 8 years, it's just been beat up Bush. I mean, basically, that's what all the European, all the outlets in Asia and everywhere around the world that he controls, that's what they've been peddling. So Obama could make a certain amount of promise on that because he can now feed the storyline, oh, we have a great American president now, someone you should love. And that will be the storyline that goes out through those media outlets, and it will have a big effect. Here's what I'm seeing happen. Barack Obama is of the foreign policy school, which is, you know, an international socialist idea, that the reason the terrorists do not like us is because we are rich, we have so much money, so much opportunity here, and because we have been meddling in their affairs. And a lot of it, they think, has to do with the Israeli, the state of Israel and our backing of them. And then a lot of it also had to do with us going into Iraq. So I think what they're going to feed now will be the storyline, well, we haven't brought them up to our standard yet, so that's why they still don't like us. That's the socialist feed, you know. Until we make everybody in the world just as well off as everybody else, then they're still going to hate us. And it won't be until we equalize the wealth around the world, that until that happens, we're still going to have those enemies. I personally don't think that Obama's going to change all that much foreign policy. I think he's going to be a much more domestically oriented president like Clinton was, which means he's going to turn over probably a lot of the foreign policy to the wonks and to Hillary. He will be more domestically oriented. That's what I think.
Kyle Ann Schieber, thanks for being on The Savage Nation.
Savage.
Here's what we've been talking about in The Savage Nation. How have drugs made your life better? The passion of Obama. Madoff was about to send $173 million to friends and relatives. Let's go to topic one. How have drugs made your life better? It's amazing. Every time I bring up the topic of the dangers of marijuana, I get people calling the show saying that it hasn't impacted their abilities. Of course, I show them the medical facts that it suppresses the immune system. It has more tar than a normal nicotine-bearing cigarette. But they still insist pot is good for them. All right. So tell me how pot or any other similar drug, for that matter, has had a positive impact on your life. I'll let the audience listen and decide whether they agree. Or if for some reason drugs haven't been so good for you, tell me your worst drug horror story. And now we turn to the Ghanaian thief, Madoff, who was about to send $173 million in checks to friends and relatives. Now here is a man who, even under house arrest, is still trying to perpetrate more fraud on his investors. The only thing standing between him and the hard jail is a corrupt judge, in my opinion, Ronald Ellis. Do you know anything about Judge Ellis? Well, we're going to disclose it here on The Savage Nation. Why won't they revoke his bail and send him to jail immediately? Follow the money. Follow the money. See if there's any connection between Madoff's donations to the NYU Law School or any of the other foundations or funds that Judge Ellis has presided over. In the 1980s, Michael Milken was a Wall Street criminal who did jail time. Today he's back on the outside with billions of dollars. Is there any reason to believe that the corrupt system will deal with Madoff any differently? But there are other topics out there. 1-800-449-8255. It seems as though the entire media has gone insane over Barack Obama and his upcoming inauguration. The empty suits and the empty skirts are making him into the next Messiah. And others who don't understand history are praising him as the next FDR. In a way, they may be right, but that's because they don't know the real history of FDR. But I've got a report from Jeff Kuhner of the Washington Times to set them straight. Jeff, tell the people the real story behind this.
Thank you, Michael. The buzz here in Washington is that Obama is now planning a massive economic stimulus package. And at the heart of this economic stimulus package is Obama's pledge for a massive public works campaign. What he is seeking to do is literally put together a $1 trillion spending program, which will include some tax cuts, but mostly huge spending projects on roads, bridges, modernizing hospitals, upgrading schools, building highways. In other words, this is going to be a comprehensive spending program to bolster the country's national infrastructure. And what the Democrats are claiming and what Obama is claiming is that this is going to be a massive success story, that this will create or save about 3 million jobs. The only problem with this is that the original New Deal from which it is based on was a complete and utter failure. And this has been, Michael, the great myth of the 20th century. It is the myth that has sustained American liberalism for nearly 100 years. And that is that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal saved the American economy, and more importantly, that Roosevelt's visionary leadership gave us hope in a time of crisis, and more importantly, even than that, that his leadership helped us defeat fascism in Europe and in Asia. And that, to me, Michael, is what I find most disgusting about all of this, because it is a complete and utter fraud and a myth. Prior to myself becoming a journalist, I spent many years as a historian, and my area of expertise is the 1920s and the 1930s. And what to me is most stunning is that Roosevelt's New Deal, in fact, did the very opposite of what liberals claim. It never engendered economic recovery. We never tackled the problems of unemployment and poverty. In fact, the American economy remained in a depression throughout the entire 1930s. So the New Deal, this supposed public works spending program, all of these spending initiatives, all of these welfare policies, all of these regulations, all of these tax hikes that Roosevelt implemented and that Obama wants to implement, we know for a historical fact they completely failed. And more than that, Michael, what to me is most galling and shameful of all is that if you look at Roosevelt's New Deal and if you look at his foreign policy, he, in fact, was the exact opposite of a champion for American democracy. He was the one who openly welcomed Neville Chamberlain in appeasement of Hitler in Munich in 1938. Instead of increasing defense spending, the only place that he really cut was in defense. He cut our defense budget. So while Winston Churchill and a few other brave patriots were warning about the gathering storm on the horizon, that Hitler's Germany was ready to march across Europe and declare war and throw the Jews into the ovens and unleash a horror like we had never seen before, Franklin Roosevelt refused to contain Hitler's Germany or Imperial Japan. He was not a forceful and visionary leader. In fact, he was the exact opposite. He is like Barack Obama today. He is a reactive leader who has no moral or ideological core. And yet, because of a fawning, sycophantic press corps in the 1930s, which covered up all of his failures and covered up all of his foreign policy blunders, the American people were misled and manipulated into believing that Franklin Roosevelt, in fact, was the greatest president we had ever had in the 20th century. It was an absolute lie. And Michael, what worries me the most here, and I think what should worry most of your listeners, is that I believe we are now sleepwalking towards disaster. Sitting here in the belly of the beast, seeing the congressional Democrats up close, knowing Obama and his transition team closely and personally, having seen these people in action, they have no idea what they are doing. Just as Roosevelt, they are willing to throw good money after bad down a rat hole. in the vain hope that somehow this will reverse the economic downturn. So now they are willing to put forward a $1 trillion spending package. They are now already talking about a $1.5 trillion. Some Democrats are even talking about a $2 trillion deficit next year. And for what? Are we guaranteed that this is going to be a success? Are we guaranteed that suddenly we're going to have full employment? That our stock market is going to be completely restored? That our financial institutions will be saved? No, they don't even know themselves. They are gambling with our tax money. They are gambling with our future on something that they don't even know is going to work. This is what is the greatest scandal of all, that the media is cheerleading as we literally dig ourselves into the biggest bankruptcy hole that this country has ever seen. $1.5 to $2 trillion next year, and maybe another $1.5 to $2 trillion the following year. We are literally going to drive ourselves into bankruptcy. And this is being done with the acquiescence of the Washington Press Corps. And this is why it is very important that all of us as conservatives stand up and say clearly, we are going to take our movement back, we are going to take the Republican Party back, and we are going to take our country back. Because we are no longer going to stand by and allow more welfare policies, more big government spending programs, more bridges to nowhere, pork barrel spending, public works programs, all sorts of gadgets and spending gimmicks that we know historically have shown do not work. They are spending our money literally like drunken sailors. And instead of standing by and saying, yes, we are going to allow our tax money to be misused and misappropriated to buy votes, we as conservatives should stand up clearly and unequivocally and push the Republican Party to say, no, we will hold the Democrats accountable. And in 2010, we will take back Congress and we will stop this liberal juggernaut right in its tracks. Michael, this is Jeff Kuhner signing out here at the Washington Times. Thanks again for all the great work that you do, and I'll see you next week.
Excellent report, Jeff. The average person just doesn't understand this and just takes the word of the ultra, ultra liberal media for real.
Savage.
Terrorists have opened a second front in Israel. As Israel was defending itself against rocket attacks in the south on its border with Gaza, the Hezbollah terrorists have now decided to attack with rockets on their northern front from Lebanon. And though the Lebanese government has made its standard denunciations and the West followed suit in short order with its perfunctory condemnations, the bottom line is that Israel's very life as a nation is at stake. Never forget that Israel is surrounded on three sides by its enemies, and on the fourth side by the sea. This is the second front for Israel. It is but one more of countless fronts that the terrorists have opened around the world. The terrorists in this case, the Muslim fanatics, may be motivated by hatred of Israel, but this does not explain the fronts they have opened in Spain, in England, in the United States, in Indonesia, in India, in the Philippines. On all continents, Muslim fanatics have demonstrated their eagerness to destroy modern life. And it is that deeper hatred of a just humanity that drives their murderous lust. So when you see Israel defending itself against Hamas, Hezbollah, and any number of other groups that want to destroy it, please don't forget that this is only a small part of an enormous war. A war that was started by and is continued by fanatic rejects from the 9th century. This is not a war that can be waged by Israel alone. It will require all the strength of the civilized world to squash the intensity of the Islamo-fascist hatred. This fight will not be served by petty undermining complaints by reporters from Fox News not being able to access the war zone. It will not be served by complaints about civilian casualties, which have occurred to some degree in every war in the last 150 years. This fight and the existence of Western civilization itself will not be served by those who feel it is their duty to report every issue as if it had equal arguments and equal morality on both sides. You cannot equate madmen to those defending themselves against madmen. And the sooner that we as a society learn that, the sooner we can shut down these fronts of hatred once and for all. Remember this, even if Israel disappeared tomorrow, God forbid it should happen, Muslim fanatics would be on the march in the nations that it is still fighting with, wherever you look, fighting in Spain, in England, in France, in Germany, in the United States, in Indonesia, wherever you turn, 9th century throwbacks trying to take down the modern world. I'm going to talk about these and other topics even if the rest of the media refuses to. Obama has gotten himself into a corner with the appointment of Leon Panetta to the position of CIA director, a man with no qualifications for the job. As I've said before, he may not last. He may suddenly discover that he needs to spend more time with his family. But the most interesting thing about this is where the opposition to his nomination has come from. And for more on that, we go to reporter Ken Timmerman.
Well, Michael, what I find most interesting about this Panetta appointment is that the opposition to it is coming primarily from Democrats in the Senate. You have Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who is the incoming chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who has said she was blindsided. She wasn't consulted before the nomination was made. Now, this is extraordinary because until now, the Obama people have been, in fact, very careful to orchestrate their nominations. This is the first time they've had this kind of slip-up. We have Joe Biden, the incoming vice president, who's already apologized for it, but I don't think that's going to go far enough. Leon Panetta is going to face a difficult confirmation hearing. It's going to be difficult, first of all, because of that lack of greasing the political skids. It's going to be difficult after that because he does not have the experience that he needs to have to do this kind of job. It's going to be difficult also because the left wing of the Democrat Party has launched its own objections to other potential nominees to head the CIA, in particular John Brennan, who was a former senior agency manager, that the left claim was involved in the Bush so-called torture policies and mistreatment of detainees. Now, you know, how you mistreat detainees who were responsible for 9/11 is something that might be beyond most of us. But nevertheless, the left has objected to this. There are people on the right who have said that the problem Leon Panetta is going to have after nomination, should he be confirmed, is his total lack of experience with the intelligence community. Frank Gaffney, who's a good friend of mine, I interviewed him for Newsmax.com just the other day, said Panetta is going to wind up spending an inordinate amount of his time when he comes to CIA just learning to find his way to the bathroom. Now, that's a way of giving you an idea of the kind of boning up that he will have to do to understand what the U.S. intelligence community does from day to day and what its weaknesses are. Others have said that, in fact, his lack of experience could be a benefit. Now, they argue that this is because the agency is being run right now, especially the clandestine service, by a clique of operations officers, highly privileged, who are out, in fact, to protect their privilege as much as, if not more, than national security. These are the old guard of the clandestine service, people who have never recruited a live agent in their lives, and yet who have risen to very, very senior positions without taking risks. The whole idea of risk-taking is the most important thing right now at CIA. There is a culture at the agency, an avoidance of taking risks that, in fact, led directly up to the 9/11 crisis. This is the single most important thing that any incoming CIA director needs to grapple with, and the question is going to be, is Leon Panetta up to that task? Now, Michael, I can't tell you from the inside whether Panetta is up to the task or not. What I can tell you, though, is that there's a real problem of leadership at the CIA. They need visionary leadership, people who can step up to the plate, reform the agency, recruit new officers, and give them support. You know, Mike Hayden, the current director, has been successful in getting young people to join CIA as operations officers, but he's been less successful in retaining them. I'm hearing stories from my sources of young officers, patriots, who've joined the CIA to do the right thing since 9/11 and who have already left in disgust at the, again, at this aversion to taking risk culture at the agency. Here, if you want to judge how Leon Panetta does at CIA, here, I believe, is the first thing to look at. See whether or not he fires the number two at the agency, Steve Kappas. Now, Steve Kappas is somebody I've tracked for quite some time. You can read about him in my book, Shadow Warriors, The Untold Story of Traitors, Saboteurs, and the Party of Surrender. He was the leader of the so-called rogue weasels at the agency who were opposing the policies of George W. Bush and politicizing the agency. I think Kappas needs to go. He represents the old guard. He represents this risk-adverse culture at the CIA. He has never recruited an agent in his life, a foreign agent in his life, and he has, in fact, steered the CIA towards these liaison relationships with other countries, where, in fact, we rely on intelligence, on the intelligence services of Jordan, of Egypt, of France and Germany and others, without having our own agents. As astonishing as it may seem, I can tell you right now, we do not have a single agent on the ground inside Iran today. We don't have anybody in the Iranian leadership. We don't have anybody inside the Iranian nuclear weapons program. We don't have anybody of our own that we control inside Iran today. Any intelligence that we're getting is coming either from these liaison relationships, in other words, from foreign intelligence services who might be trying to fool us or trick us or to lead us astray, or it's coming from technical means, from satellite intercepts. So Steve Kappas has got to go. If Leon Panetta fires him, I would say that's a very good sign. This man wants to reform the agency, wants to start doing the right things. If he doesn't, I fear we're just going to go down this road where the risk-adverse culture is going to win out, and we're going to be surprised again in the future by another terrorist attack. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Ken. A fascinating report. It's not Obama's first mistake, and it won't be his last. Psychological nudity. You didn't buy it for the Christmas holidays. You saved your money. The economy collapsed. All right, so you missed reading One Arm Frank, Love by the Sewer Plant, Dead Man's Pants, Tippy the Dog Dies and is Thrown in a Garbage Truck, Fat Al's Tuna. That doesn't mean you have to miss these great stories. You can still buy Psychological Nudity. It's still the same beautiful hardcover edition. I designed the book myself. It's only $19.99 for this hardcover book. It is not available in stores. It is only available through my website, michaelsavage.com. So go to michaelsavage.com, order Psychological Nudity, Savage Radio Stories, over 75 stories from Savage's colorful life contained in this one volume, plus favorite stories that have never before been published. All right, get this special deal by going to michaelsavage.com and order Psychological Nudity, only $19.99, michaelsavage.com.
Savage.